I'm Robert Riley, director of the Westminster Institute. And today I'm delighted to welcome back to our program Professor Steve Hanke, who is professor of applied economics and founder and co-director of the Institute for Applied Economics, Global Health, and the Study of Business Enterprise at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. He's also a senior fellow at the Independent Institute in Oakland, California, a senior advisor at the Renmin University of China's International Monetary Research Institute in Beijing, and a special counselor to the Center for Financial Stability in New York. Steve is also a contributing editor at Central Banking in London and a contributor at National Review. In addition, Dr. Hanke is a member of the Charter Council of the Society for Economic Measurement and of the Euromoney Country Risk Experts Panel. He served as a senior economist on President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors in 1981-82, and as a senior advisor to the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress in 84-88. Dr. Hanke served as a state counselor to both the Republic of Lithuania in 94-96, and the Republic of Montenegro in 99-2003. He was also an advisor to the President of Bulgaria in 97-2002, Venezuela in 95-96, and Indonesia in 1998. He played an important role in establishing new currency regimes in Argentina, Estonia, Bulgaria, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Ecuador, Lithuania, and Montenegro. Today, Dr. Hanke is joining us to discuss a new book of which he is co-author, titled "Do Lockdowns Work? The Verdict on COVID Restrictions." The other co-authors of the study are Jonas Herby, special advisor at the Center for Political Studies in Copenhagen, and Lars Jonung, an economics professor at Lund University in Sweden. Steve, welcome back to the Westminster Institute.
Great to be with you, Bob.
If I can just kick it off with this personal recollection of the outbreak of COVID, Steve, I remember very, very keenly when the projections by the Imperial College London hit the American press, projecting that if nothing were done, 2.2 million people in the United States would die from COVID. And in Great Britain, the body count would be 500,000.
Yes.
That simply induced widespread panic. Now, you deal with this projection in your book. Could you comment about the Imperial College London and what they did? And
Well, the Imperial College London and the epidemiologists there are considered in the epidemiological sphere, shall we say, that professional grouping to be, you know, very, very highly regarded, shall we say, their models, kind of the gold standard for these epidemiological models. Actually, they had two models, the Imperial College. One model estimated that the losses and deaths in the United States would be 1.7, and then the top one, as you mentioned, was 2.2. So you got, let's say, roughly 2 million people would die if you didn't lock down, if you did nothing. So our study, what did we find out? And what appeared in that first working paper, depending on the measures we use for lockdowns, we determined with this meta-analysis that there were between 4,000 and 16,000 deaths, not 2 million. 4,000 deaths saved, or 16,000 at the high end saved because of lockdowns.
Over what period of time?
Well, this is 2020. So there, right away, with that, again, with that huge gap between the model's numbers coming out of the Imperial College and our findings of what actually is being measured on the ground. I mean, ex post facto, what really happened? Well, you had a tiny number, because remember, to put this thing in context, these are all large numbers. Even 4,000 to 16,000 lives saved. Well, that's a big number, and every life is important. But in a normal flu season in the United States, about 38,000 people die of the flu. So that's why we can say the lockdowns, our conclusion, they had a tiny effect, health effect, tiny health effects. So the lives saved are pretty small. And of course, we know the cost of shutting down the economy was just enormous. And that's why we conclude that the lockdown should be rejected out of hand. And they probably ended up being one of the most catastrophic public policy mistakes in the modern era, the COVID lockdowns around the world, not only in the United States, but around the world.
Now, the first question that may arise to you as a world monetary expert and a highly successful currency arbitrageur is, what are you doing studying the effects of the lockdown? Some might say you and your co-authors are not in the health profession. You're not epidemiologist. What instigated this rather rigorous study? I should have mentioned that your book, Do Lockdowns Work, is quite a substantial piece of some 220 pages and heavy on the methodology to try to ensure that what you call a meta-analysis gives a real reflection of the subject matter.
You actually put your finger on in the introduction, really. You said I was a member of the Charter Council for the Society of Economic Measurement. And this study, this meta-analysis, is all about measuring things. But it actually goes back to a lot of work that I did even when I was a graduate student, and that's measuring things. My PhD work actually was measuring the effect of the installation of water meters on water use, what we call in economics, price elasticities, I was estimating. And just how sensitive the demand for something is relative to the price that's being charged for it. So at any rate, measurement is basically part of my life as an economist. We talked about currencies. Of course, you're measuring different things that are affecting the exchange rate between currencies. So measurement becomes important there. National income accounting and international accounts and so forth. And so this meta study, what is a meta study? Why did I get involved with this measurement aspect of lockdowns? Again, it's kind of an elasticity type of thing. How effective are lockdowns given the stringency of the lockdown? You can start with a little small intervention, get it bigger, bigger, bigger. Does this actually change the mortality rate, the death rate that you're looking at? That's what we were looking at. So I got together with Jonig. It happens to be an old collaborator of mine. The first book we wrote together was called, the title of it's called Russian Currency and Finance. And then the second, we wrote another book together on the Estonian currency. That was prior to our establishing a currency board in 1992 in Estonia. So Jonig and I go way back, and Jonig called me and he said, we really should be looking at this. This is a huge policy issue, this lockdown thing. And in Sweden, he's a Swede, they had a very laissez-faire kind of approach to COVID. They weren't mandating a lot of lockdowns. And one reason for that, Jonig and I found out, is that in the Constitution of Sweden, which is a 16th century constitution, it would be illegal to lock somebody down in Sweden. It would be unconstitutional because they're guaranteed, as the word liberty is included in the Swedish Constitution. And Swedes are given the liberty to move freely. No one can restrict the movement of a Swede. That would be unconstitutional if you do that in Sweden. So that was kind of the first step. And then the second step was, you know, who's been studying this? Who's been looking at these effects? And we, Jonig had located the work of Herbie in Denmark, and the three of us decided, well, let's do a big meta-analysis of all the research that's being done on this to figure out what these measurements are, what's going on. And we started. And the meta-analysis is where you take all the potential studies that are available out there. That's why meta comes into it. And screen these to see if they're, which ones are appropriate, which ones can be compared to each other, which ones can be kind of, you can normalize the data so you actually can compare what you've got. You don't have a lot of apples and oranges, but you got all apples or oranges. So we started with about 20,000 studies we reviewed, and we whittled that down to actually only 22 were hot, very high quality, could be normalized, could be compared. And those are the 22 that went into our meta-analysis. We can move on from what we found and what the whole thing was about, but that's kind of a long-winded introduction, Bob, but it gets into the measurement thing. Measurement is not something that's uncommon for me. I'm measuring things all the time.
Parenthetically, Steve, I do note that the name of the institute of which you are the co-founder is Institute for Applied Economics Global Health.
Absolutely.
No. On the study of enterprise, business enterprise. So it's not exactly a subject that's foreign to the concerns of your institute, since
it isn't. That's an interesting point. No, number one, as you know, Johns Hopkins is the center for anything in medicine and health, and the Bloomberg School of Public Health of Johns Hopkins actually is the number one school in public health in the world. So that's one thing. There's this general Hopkins thing, but there's a very specific thing, and that is the co-founder of the institute that I founded is Professor Louis Galambos. And Lou Galambos is an expert on the history, the business history and development of the pharmaceutical industry in the United States. And among other things, he has a book on the history and development of vaccines. So it comes very close to this whole COVID thing. So that's Galambos. He's a very distinguished professor and a great friend and colleague.
So Steve, this extensive study that you have published went through several iterations. Is that not right?
Yes. We first published that paper as a working paper at the Institute for the Johns Hopkins Institute for Applied Economics, Global Health, and the Study of Business Enterprise. And it created a, shall we say, a stir, because actually a professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins mentioned this study as being path-breaking and so forth. And he mentioned it in an interview on Tucker Carlson's Fox television program. So you can imagine right away, you got a Hopkins medical professor saying this study is the best thing since sliced bread. And he's saying it on Tucker Carlson. Well, immediately that working paper made it. That I think the next day it was a subject that came up at the White House press briefing, and people are waving it around on Capitol Hill, senators and congressmen and so forth. But almost immediately, it was jumped on by the, shall we say, the public health establishment. All kinds of actually kind of amusing, ridiculous charges, but the fact checkers got into it. You know, this is something new. You and I didn't have to deal with this in the early days when we were in the Reagan administration, but now that's that latest thing is fact checking. So they had some, you know, I suppose 20-year-old fact checking our working paper. I'm certain they didn't even read the thing. But immediately, there were just ridiculous things being said about it. Like it wasn't peer reviewed. Well, academic working papers are not peer reviewed. That's the whole point. You publish a working paper so that it can circulate, so people can criticize it, so you can then improve, make any corrections, clarifications, and so forth, which we did, and we published the second edition of it. And then eventually the Institute for Economic Affairs, after a lot of additional work and so forth, published what the seed of that book they published, the 225-page book, was the working paper. That's normally what happens. And by the way, that book was heavily peer reviewed before the Institute for Economic Affairs published it. And based on those peer reviews, we then did some, there were no corrections that were required, but the typical kind of clarification and so forth. Then the Institute for Economic Affairs published the book, and we can talk about what's in the book or whatever else.
I think we ought to get to the substance of what's in there, because it's very intriguing. But I will note that in the final version published by the Institute for Economic Affairs, you have appendices, extensive appendices, and you also answer in great detail the criticisms that the paper has received, so that there's a kind of thoroughness in what you have offered here that is very impressive. I also ought to tell our viewers, Steve, that your book, Do Lockdowns Work, is available online. If someone just Googles the title, it will go to the Institute for Economic Affairs, and you can download the book and read it. Just
right. And Bob, the price is right. It's zero.
Yes, it's like water without a water meter.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You know,
so one thing that's in the fact-checking appendix you mentioned is the fact that right after our working paper came out, I think a major reason why the Imperial College London reacted to it is it was published at Johns Hopkins. We're not talking about some rinky-dink university that no one has ever heard of or has no reputation. But if anything on medicine or health comes out of Johns Hopkins, it makes waves all around the world. It's a big deal.
Steve, you talk about the track record of the Imperial College London, the other projections they have made that were way off the mark. Can you address those?
Yeah. Let me address those, and then we'll get to this press release that reacted to our first working paper coming from the Imperial College. So the Imperial College models, let's look at the track record. 2001, we remember foot and mouth, the foot and mouth disease. The Imperial College of London had their model said that the daily case rate for foot and mouth would peak at 420 cases per day. It actually, at the time they published that paper, the peak had already occurred, and it was 50. It wasn't 420, it was 50. Then less than a year later, in January 2002, mad cow showed up. And the Imperial College of London, the epidemiological model, said that there'd be 150,000 deaths in the UK due to mad cow. But the total number ended up being 178. Then 2005, bird flu. Imperial College of London said there would be 200 million deaths occurring globally by 2021, 16 years later. There have only been 456 deaths. Then we had 2009, swine flu. And Imperial College London was out there again. They said there'd be 65,000 deaths. And that's what the model said. The model spun out 65,000 deaths. By March of 2010, there'd only been 500 deaths. So So you can see why I call the Imperial College of London numbers fantasy numbers. They're just a huge gap between what they project and what actually happened. So we come to the press release from the folks at Imperial College London, and the press release was highly critical of our work. And they said things like, we weren't epidemiologists. That's a ridiculously stupid remark, by the way. We are economists, we're not epidemiologists, but we're measuring things. We're just going in there after the catastrophe to measure what happened. We're not modeling or predicting what was going to happen. We're just counting bodies. And by the way, economists are pretty good at this. They are good at looking at behavioral models and figuring out, you know, if you have 10 things going on that could be affecting something in the economy, like the price elasticity, for example, or the elasticity of mortality as it relates to the severity of lockdowns, economists are, that's what they should know how to do. So at any rate, they criticized that, said it wasn't peer reviewed, said it wasn't sponsored by Johns Hopkins University. That was another stupid thing that the fact checkers got into. It was public. Johns Hopkins doesn't put a stamp of approval on every article and every publication that Hopkins professors publish. That's not the way academics work. Universities don't put a good housekeeping stamp of approval on everything every professor publishes. And it was published by, number one, a professor from Johns Hopkins, myself, who, from a chronological point of view, I'm the most senior professor at Johns Hopkins. I've been here 54 years. And it was published at a Johns Hopkins Institute. So that got under their skin, and they were trying to poo-poo the fact, disassociate Hopkins with this study. That was the purpose of the thing. So all of that was picked up in the press, but there actually was a very favorable commentary on that press release that came out of London. You had the Imperial College of London people, but then you had another professor commenting that it was the most rigorous study that was available on this topic. But the press ignored that completely. And one reason they do this, in England now, they have found out that throughout the COVID, there's something called the Counter Disinformation Unit in the government, the CDU. Now, the U.S. has the same kind of thing going on, but in England, they actually uncovered this thing. And the Telegraph newspaper in London actually, on June 7th, revealed the fact that they had discovered this secret unit. That what was the secret unit doing? It was canceling studies like ours that were running counter to the received wisdom that the government was pumping out, the Tory government of Boris Johnson that was locking everybody down in England. They didn't want any criticisms. They latched on to the Imperial College of London's estimate of 500,000 deaths, as you pointed out early, Bob. And they said, given this, we are going to lock down. And so the steps in going through it are fairly clear. There's something called the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, SAGE, in the UK. And SAGE used the models from the Imperial College of London, the fantasy numbers, and SAGE, of course, they have no economists. I would argue they have a lot of epidemiologists on the SAGE group. And using these fantasy numbers, they go to 10 Downing Street in the House of Commons. It's scare the pants off of all the politicians with these huge numbers. And there's no filtering of the data. There's no critique of it. There's no one looking back to see how the Imperial College of London had performed in the past. All these things we went through with bird flu, foot and mouth, mad cow, and all these other things. They didn't go back to conclude, oh, all these models are rubbish. They're producing rubbish at the Imperial College of London. No, they didn't do any of that. They just took on the results of the models and they locked down Great Britain.
I'm just going to mention a story from March 2020 on another prediction of the Imperial College London that the coronavirus pandemic could have caused 40 million deaths if left unchecked. So it goes beyond the catastrophic numbers for the United States and Great Britain, overall of 40 million deaths. I'll just quickly say even in the Trump administration, and of course, Dr. Anthony Fauci would say that the measures that were taken in the United States greatly mitigated the prospect of 2.2 million people dying here, you know, kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. They could say, look, see, it worked.
Right. So the question is, well, did it work? And that's what we got into the measurements. What did it actually do? And we gave you the numbers. The U.S. it saved between, depending again on how you calibrate the lockdowns, how severe they were and so forth, between 4,000 and 16,000 lives were saved due to the fact of these various lockdowns. Now, you say, well, what do you mean lockdowns? Well, there are lots of different things that go into it. One, we used what they call a stringency index from Oxford University, developed this thing. So that's where you get kind of this elasticity thing. You go from light lockdowns to heavier, 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 and you see does the mortality rate go down as you increase the stringency. That's one approach. That gives you the 4,000 number. If you look at all the other, what they call non-pharmaceutical interventions, that's shelter-in-place mandates, mask mandates, business closure mandates, limiting gatherings, the size of gathering, school closures. If you add all of those up, the max you get is about 16,000 lives saved. So you're shutting down the economy. You have tiny health effects, and the question is that what do the politicians do? Well, the politicians do something that's very classic. That's fear mongering. Fear mongering, you scare the pants off everybody, basically, and because you've instituted a radical policy. Shutting the economy down is very radical. So you shut the economy down, you have to justify and rationalize that. So you have these high numbers coming out of Imperial College, and the politicians cranking up on the fear mongering. That's part of what happened in the sequence. But afterwards, after things like our study comes out, and there, by the way, there are other studies that complement now our study that have been coming out almost every day. If these studies contradict and show how stupid and catastrophic the policy was, then the cover-up starts. So that's what they're doing now. And that's part of this counter-disinformation unit. Or you read a lot about what's going on. Remember, we just had this case coming out of Louisiana. A judge earlier this week or over the weekend said that the U.S. government could not engage in arm-twisting, Facebook and Twitter and various social media venues of one sort or another, because that's what they do. They shut you down. And they shut you down because the cover-up. So the first phase of the government is fear. Strike the fear of God into everybody, and that will give us a green light to proceed with any cockamamie policy we want to. So that's one thing. The second thing then, after the fact, and once people start measuring things, Bob, and figuring out that the health effects were pretty tiny, and we know that the costs were massive and so forth, then the cover-up starts. So what's a cover-up? The cover-up is for incompetence. The public health officials clearly are incompetent. These models are incompetent. They're El Nutso. They generate rubbish. So that's one thing they're covering up for. And the other thing is they're just covering up for what were, in fact, very controversial policies. So that's what we're into now. Now we're in the cover-up game. By the way, that's why you see in the press, you do have coverage around the fringes of our book, by the way, which, as you say, it's a heavy lift. It's not the kind of thing you want to read before driving. And that has not been covered in the mainline press, as far as I know, except in England. In the United States, it's been canceled. In England, it's been widely reported, starting with quite extensive reportage in the Telegraph, which is a mainline conservative paper, newspaper in Great Britain.
Steve, I wanted to mention my field of study. It was not economics, it was political philosophy. So I'm going to refer to the fear-mongering that you mentioned. One thing I just studied is Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan, the famous book in which Hobbes justified the absolute power of the sovereign. Why would people accede to vesting that kind of power in the state sovereign? Out of fear of a violent death. So that was the basis of political life, that the sovereign would protect people. You could say it was an early health measure. You wouldn't get killed if you simply assigned to the sovereign absolute power. So it was Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan that came to my mind as I witnessed the various emergency measures taken not just by the federal government, but in the Commonwealth of Virginia that were quite extraordinary, if not extra constitutional. What was and how was this extraordinary power vested in the governor here? It was also based on fear, not fear of a violent death, but fear of death by COVID. And by using that fear, the governors in certain states accrued absolutely extraordinary power. I have here page after page of the executive orders issued by the governor under these powers that he assumed, from stay at home, emergency funding for housing options for homeless, increase in minimum wage, restaurants closed, additional $70 million in child care, ban on elective surgeries, postpone the state and special elections, relief options for more than 200,000 Virginians with privately held student loans, right? I mean, this goes absolutely on and on. 740,000 Virginians who receive supplemental nutrition assistance benefits will be able to pay for groceries online, have them delivered. Statewide temporary moratorium on evictions. Good luck, landlords. Virginia Artists Relief Program, a program to assist visual artists impacted by COVID-19. Under the program, 40 visual artists from the Commonwealth will be selected to receive a $5,000 grant. I mean, I think I've done enough, but that's just scraping the surface of this. So in Virginia, the Commonwealth here, my parish church was closed. I couldn't go to mass, but I think I could go to a strip club. You know, the arbitrary nature of these measures, this Hobbesian regime founded on fear of death by COVID, was, as I think you say in your study, the greatest restriction of civil liberties that possibly we've ever experienced since the Civil War.
Well, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought Hobbes in. And, you know, Nothing beats a good thorough study of political philosophy if you're actually in the public policy sphere. So these classics, most of these things are all laid out in the classics if you read them and connect the dots. There's nothing new under the sun, as they say. But the interesting thing, now back to the strip club, now there, I suppose the rationale for that is that there was social distancing. But I'm not certain whether there was any particular reason for that exemption. In any case, new studies that have come out, Casey Mulligan, a University of Chicago professor, a distinguished professor, has just finished a study where Casey and his colleagues have determined state by state the kind of state effects of these lockdowns. And their findings are very consistent with our meta-analysis. And what they find in the United States is that the states that locked down tight essentially got no benefits relative to the states that didn't lock down much. So again, the benefit cost calculus was lockdowns were a huge negative. And that study actually was just released this week. You can Google Casey Mulligan, University of Chicago, and you'll find it.
Now, Steve, you are careful in this study with your co-authors to discriminate, to say what things actually do seem to have mitigated the effects of COVID. And one thing you report on favorably are masks.
Yes. The masks seem... Now, by the way, stepping back to our meta-analysis, the meta-analysis is doing what? It's taking these 22 high-quality studies that can be kind of normalized and compared and doing that exercise. So in a sense, it's what you and I used to call a review of the literature. Now, the modern term is a meta-analysis. But in the old days, you just review the literature and compare what various studies were saying and concluding and so forth. So what we found out is that actually the out of these so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions, the masks seem to have the largest positive payoff in terms of mortality.
Well, and then there's a counterintuitive report. In the study, it states that it seems that limiting gatherings was counterproductive, that it not only didn't limit the spread of COVID, but it somehow contributed to it.
Yeah, well, no, what you did, it keeps everybody at home with the family, and they're spreading the stuff amongst themselves. It in fact kind of reduces social distancing because you tend to concentrate family groups amongst themselves. By the way, there are a number of huge negative things that this study by Casey Mulligan came out with, for example, and that we get into this, but this new study by Casey gets into it in much more detail, and that is that the unintended negative health effects, you had alcoholism went up a lot, drug use went up a lot, suicides went up a lot, mental health problems went up a lot, and they get in and they measure this. So not only it had de minimis or tiny impacts relative to a normal flu season, for example. We found that in our meta-analysis that the lives saved were really relatively small, even compared to regular flu season. The mandates saved, depending on, again, how you measure lockdowns and the stringency of lockdowns, in the United States, between 4,000 and 16,000 lives. But the normal flu season, about 38,000 people die just from flu. But that isn't the end of the story on the health thing, because the negative health things associated with lockdowns appear to be very significant. This work Casey Mulligan has done, you had alcoholism, alcohol problems went up, drug problems went up, suicides went up, mental health problems went up. All of those are big negative factors. And in fact, there were a lot of deaths associated with the lockdowns. In other words, we measured the lives saved, but there also were a lot of lives that were lost due to lockdowns and associated negative unintended consequences associated with the lockdowns. That's part of the picture.
Yeah, the people who suffered as a consequence of delaying elective surgeries, as you heard the governor here at that
yes.
time.
Yes, back to Hobbes and Leviathan. This is a very important point, because now what do we have? We have the cover up for the bad policy, okay, and the incompetence. But one reason why they're covering that up is, of course, to cover their tails, like, you know, typically with government screw-ups or any kind of screw-up. There's always a cover-up, whether it's in the government or the private sector. But another reason for that is Hobbes and Leviathan, because the World Health Organization is on this fear thing, and they're ginning up, with, of course, the backing of the Gates Foundation and other public health advocates, of a world government, a world regulation of this. So the next pandemic that comes, watch out, because we now will probably have the WHO involved in some kind of world lockdown. By the way, the WHO, before the COVID, they were against lockdowns. The WHO was actually against lockdowns. They changed after this Imperial College of London modeling came out because of the fear factor. So this story is not over yet. We should be investigating what you and I are talking about. How did this thing go off the rails and was such a catastrophe? That's what we should be investigating. That's what we should have public inquiries about. And the reason for that is Hobbes and Leviathan, because if you think this was a catastrophe, you wait till the next time and the WHO is running things.
There were some recent reports, Steve, on other consequences that you haven't mentioned yet. I mean, some people might just say this is a correlation. That's not a causative relationship, but here nonetheless it is. A new Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that homicides and suicides hit a 20-year high in 2021 following lockdowns, etc. Youth suicides climbed in 2020 and 2021. The two-year increase among college age 20 to 24 was the largest in two decades. One CDC survey found about half of 18 to 24-year-olds experienced anxiety or depression during the summer of 2020. Between 2019 and 2021, the homicide rate among those aged 10 to 24 increased 37%, and even more in those 15 to 19, 44%, and 10 to 14, 56%. In 2020, I'll stop here because this is a lot to digest. In 2020, suicide was the second and homicide the fourth leading cause of death among adolescents aged 10 to 14. COVID wasn't in the top 10. Those are shocking numbers.
Yeah, they're shocking numbers. And what's interesting to me, listening to that's coming from the CDC.
Right.
Center for Disease Control. Now, there's very little play in the mainstream media about that story, that narrative. They don't want that out. And why don't they want it out? Because it makes the whole policy agenda that was embraced during COVID look bad.
Yeah, some of the social, psychological consequences of the lockdown. Is it fair to say in 2023 that we're still suffering from the economic consequences of the lockdown?
Yes, I think so. I think so. We're still suffering the consequences because once you lose income and GDP, gross national product, you can't get it back. I mean, once it gets wiped out, your wealth is just wiped out. The only people who really ended up gaining and increasing their wealth relative to GDP in the last 5 years, a five-year period, are the billionaires in the United States. Their wealth as a percent of GDP went up from 15% to 18% of GDP over the last 5 years, which takes in a little bit more time than the COVID. You look at the group that has benefited most from what I'd call government interventionism or the Hobbesian kind of Leviathan problem are the billionaires. Who benefits from big government and huge government interventions? It's the rent seekers and the rich. This idea that the little guy is the beneficiary is a joke. And the numbers, the last 5 years, billionaires' wealth as a percent of GDP has gone up from 15% to 18%. So big government is for the rich. This is another nonsensical thing. You have to remember that my 95% rule, and that is 95% of what you read in the press is either wrong or irrelevant. That's where we are. But if you look at the numbers, again, if you're measuring things, that's how we started this interview. Is you asked me about measurement. I'm always interested in let the data talk. Let the numbers talk. What are the numbers?
Well, see, the last program we did together was on the causes of inflation, which, of course, dealt with measurement and numbers. And that's a popular program. And I invite our listeners to go back and watch Steve address that subject. We haven't yet talked about the extraordinary monetary expansion that was undertaken in response to COVID that you said is one of the reasons why we have suffered through this bout of inflation. So you could more or less directly relate that loose monetary policy to a COVID reaction, could you not?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about it. The money supply started exploding when the government expenditure started exploding, and that was roughly in February of 2020. Just skyrocketed. So it's all related to it. They started dishing out money. The federal government did immediately. You went through some of these things. You itemized some of the things that were going on in Virginia earlier, but it was money was just being sprayed all over the place. And of course, the tax revenues weren't coming in, so you had a big deficit. So who was going to finance a deficit? Well, the Federal Reserve came in. And they bought all the bonds that were being issued to fund that deficit. And when they did that, that means the money supply goes up. They created money to finance the deficit. And that's why the inflation went up. The money supply was growing. At the peak, it was growing at about 25% year over year, the money supply. And to be consistent with hitting the Fed's inflation target of 2%, the money supply should never be growing beyond about 6%. It was growing at 25%. Of course, we had a lot of inflation. Anyone with any sense would know this. But Chairman Powell, by the way, Chairman of the Federal Reserve, he testified over and over again that, well, we're not looking at the money supply because we find no reliable connection between the money supply and economic activity and inflation. He's on the record many, many times saying that. And of course, the Fed never never did a forecast for inflation. They've got 785 economists in the Federal Reserve System, and none of these so-called experts and economists had any forecast for inflation. It hit them like a ton of bricks. And why? Because they don't have the right models. They don't adhere to the quantity theory of money. They've never heard of Milton Friedman. You name it.
Well, I think we did our program together on the causes of inflation about 9 months ago, and you made predictions that, if memory serves, have been spot on.
So far, they've been spot on. Now, inflation, by the way, we had this explosion of the money supply. John Greenwood and I predicted accurately that it would go up. We said it would peak out maybe as high as 9%. It peaked out in July of 2021 at 9.1%. So now what's happened? Now they've thrown the car into reverse at the Fed, and the money supply is actually contracting by 4% year over year. We've never seen a contraction that big since last in 1938, Bob. And inflation has come down. It's 4% now, and it's going to be coming down. So forget what you're reading in the papers, because remember, originally the Fed said, oh, this is a temporary thing. It's going to go away. You know, we got supply chain shocks and oil price surges and war in Ukraine, Putin, and all of this stuff, and it'll all go away. And now they've changed their tune. They say, oh, this is going to be a big battle. This inflation is permanent. Inflation is global. Inflation is global is nonsense. In China, you know what the inflation rate is? 0.2% per year. So the second biggest economy in the world has essentially no inflation. So, you know, tell me another story that inflation is global. It was right in the New York Times today. They have a big article today. We're speaking on, now is what? July, I've forgotten the date, 7th, just for the record. July 7th, New York Times, front page of the business section, on and on about the global inflation problem that we have to deal with. Inflation is always local. It depends on how much money the local central bank is producing and whether that's excessive or not. And a lot of them have produced excessive amounts of money, and that's because they all follow the leader. And who's the leader? The Fed. The Bank of England does what the Fed does. The European Central Bank does what the Fed does. And on and on and on you go, because you've got these international bureaucrats, I should say local bureaucrats, running the local central banks that are all in kind of an echo chamber, and the echo chamber comes from the United States.
Well, Steve, now that the money supply is contracting, as you described, at some 4% rate, unprecedented, at least since the Great Depression, a recession seems to be absolutely unavoidable.
Oh, a recession is baked in the cake, because the money supply actually peaked out in July of last year and has been coming down sharply ever since. And with a lag of around 6 to 18 months, economic activity changes as dictated by what's happened 6 to 18 months prior to the money supply. So right now, it's been about 12 months since this thing started coming down. So I think by the first quarter of next year, we'll be in the zone for a pretty good recession starting.
And we could ascribe that as another consequence of the misguided COVID policies.
Oh, absolutely. This up and down thing, stability might not be everything, but everything is nothing without stability. And that is true for the money supply. It should be stable at about 6%, 5 or 6% growth. And that would let the Fed hit the inflation target of 2% that they have. But it's gone up from What did I say? We maxed out at about 25% because of COVID. Now everything has been reversed and it's contracting by 4% year over year. And that's certainly been induced by COVID. That kind of wild behavior at the Fed, I don't think we would have seen that if we hadn't had COVID lockdowns.
Steve, I want to read the conclusion of your book. And I like to state that the book is not at all polemical. It seems to be very careful, very thorough, dealing with the criticisms you have received in a very responsible manner. Nonetheless, you and your co-authors conclude, quote, as we interpret the available evidence, a cost-benefit analysis of the lockdowns applied suggests that the policy of lockdowns represents a global policy failure of gigantic proportions, unquote.
I think that's a good way to wind up. That's the conclusion.
You know, that invites again the question, where is the accountability? Where is the mea culpa from the Imperial College London?
Now we have in the UK, the Counter Disinformation Unit of the government. This is a part of the Hobbesian kind of a plan, going back to your political philosophy remarks earlier. And so we have now a huge cover-up underway. Huge cover-up underway. And the next step will be, after the cover-up, the WHO, watch out, because the WHO is gearing up for a world. If you think this was a catastrophe, wait till the next time around, because it won't be a national policies aspect. It'll be an international, global thing.
Speaking of Hobbes, I'm reminded of the tremendous admiration that the China government received for its zero COVID policy. There was a lot of ooing and aahing in the West, and let's say a hint of jealousy that the Chinese Communist Party, which is a Hobbesian style regime, could implement the drastic measures of a complete lockdown in China. And oh, if only we were able to do that in the West. And of course, there were attempts from various governors to somewhat imitate those measures. So we're a recent story now that China started employing a zero COVID containment strategy in 2020 and credits the strict lockdowns, quarantines, border closures, and compulsory mass testing with significantly saving lives. Measures were suddenly listed in last December with little preparation, and the final surge in which about 60,000 people died, according to the official toll. Nonetheless, according to the World Health Organization, China still had a significantly lower death rate than in the U.S. and Europe. So China, the Hobbesian model, is the model. We've done a number of programs about the Communist Party and China. And I'm sort of shocked that people take seriously the statistics that they have offered. And while they implemented the zero COVID policy, I talked to doctors and said, "What is there any sense in this?" And the answer was unanimous. It can't possibly work. And in terms of measures, it makes no sense.
Yeah, the one thing we don't have really any reliable data from China that comports with the kind of thing we did on our meta-analysis. The data from China were not included in anything in the meta-analysis. That's one thing. The one thing we do know, though, is that China has paid an enormous economic cost of the strict lockdowns that they had. We do know that. We also know anecdotally that I can indicate from some of my friends in China, they literally thought they might starve to death. I mean, they really were locked down, and the biggest concern they had, at least my friends, who I think are reliable, they told me their biggest fear was that they might starve. They couldn't go out of their apartment.
Yeah, well, as you point out, the price of that is still being paid. I'm afraid we're out of time today, and I would like to thank our guest, Dr. Steve Hanke, from the Johns Hopkins University Institute for Applied Economics, Global Health, and the Study of Business Enterprises, for joining us today to discuss his new book, Do Lockdowns Work? The Verdict on COVID Restrictions. I invite our audience to go to the Westminster Institute website to see our prior show with Professor Hanke on the causes of inflation, as well as our other programs on China, Taiwan, Japan, the Russia-Ukraine war, and other subjects. I'm Robert Riley. Thank you for joining us.